Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Congress's lack of action on gun control legislation is back in the spotlight following last week's school shooting in Florida.
It's a source of concern and frustration, I think, for most American people. Every time we have a tragedy like this, people ask, well, maybe is this what it's going to take in order to get Congress and the president to do something? And my hope and prayer is that this will.
We sit down with Senator Tom Carper to discuss this issue and others on Capitol Hill. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also examine what's next after the Christina School District and state agreed on a framework to address the district's Wilmington schools. Plus, Arts Playlist takes us to a Selbyville school to learn about its mural project. And we hear from a veteran pushing lawmakers to build a memorial honoring women who have fought for this country. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Congress is in recess this week. Before the break, lawmakers passed a two-year budget deal, but failed to come up with a fix for DACA and handling the undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, known as Dreamers, who face deportation if nothing is done to renew the program that allows them to stay in the U.S. That DACA issue and gun control in the wake of last week's school shooting in Florida are likely to be front and center when the House and Senate get back to work on Capitol Hill next week. Delaware's senior Senator Tom Carper visited our studios this week to discuss these issues and more with us. I do want to start with last week's school shooting in Parkland, Florida. And one of the questions being asked by many people, including some of the students there who survived, is why hasn't Congress addressed shootings like this one with some kind of gun regulations, even things that polls show most Americans agree on, whether it be stronger or expanded background checks, banning bump stocks, assault rifle ban. Do you see any chance of changes like these coming after this latest incident?
God, I sure hope so. I hope so. I mean, you see, background, boy, I was born, my sister and I were born in West Virginia, family of hunters. I still have my grandfather's shotgun that he gave it to me after he died. I was about 12. Dad taught me to hunt when I was a kid. And my dad later in life, he was not a gun dealer, but he was a gun collector, and he would buy and sell guns. But he would buy and sell guns to people he knew, and he always talked about using common sense and everything, including the way, you know, the kind of laws we have for guns. I'm a big believer in Second Amendment rights for people to own and buy weapons. However, there's some common sense things that my dad and I used to talk about. That said, the idea of selling armor-piercing bullets, he said, well, you know, you don't really need those when you're hunting deer or a wild boar. He said the idea of folks being able to walk into a gun show and go to one gun dealer, it's a federally licensed gun dealer, you have to provide your background information, everything, and your ID. And if you have a history of mental illness or you have a felony record, then they won't sell you guns. You go to the same gun show to the next dealer over who's not federally registered and buy the same weapons. It never made much sense. My dad doesn't make much sense to me. The idea that people can buy bump stocks and turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. We don't really need that. I'm a supporter of legislation that says if you're on a terrorist watch list and you cannot fly in an airplane, you should not be able to buy a weapon. No fly, no buy. That's just common sense stuff. And if you ask American people how they feel about it, they say, well, that makes common sense. Those are good ideas. And so most people say, why don't you do that? Here's why. Today, our Republicans' friends are in the majority in the House and the Senate, and they have the White House. And they don't want to change the gun laws. Well, I'll leave it up to them to explain why. But it's a source of concern and frustration, I think, for most American people. Every time we have a tragedy like this, people ask, well, maybe is this what it's going to take in order to get Congress and the president to do something? And my hope and prayer is that this will.
Another area that's been kind of a point of frustration because of inaction is DACA and some kind of legislation to protect Dreamers, the undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. Number of bills came up short last week in the Senate. From your standpoint, what is the path forward?
I think a lot of people in this country have actually met people from other countries who have come here, maybe brought here as children and by their parents, and they've grown up here, educated here, work here. Good community citizens and servants in some cases. And There's about 700,000 of them. And the question is, are we going to send them back to the countries where they were born, even though this is the only country they most of them ever really knew? I hear from employers almost every week, almost every day, who say to me, I'm having a hard time getting people to come to work to do a wide range of jobs. I was in a financial institution the other day. They were having trouble getting people who can have the kind of technology skills and can actually do the technology that the banks need. I talked to last week. We had people in D.C. from Central and Southern Delaware who run landscaping businesses. They have a similar problem. You have people who are in the poultry businesses, and they have a problem. It's all over the state, all over the country. Today, about 2 to 3 million jobs that are not being filled. I mean, businesses opened up, people want to work, and 2 to 3 million jobs were unfilled because the folks who are needed to fill those jobs either don't have the skills, the education, the work ethic, they can't pass a drug test. And so in the middle of all of this, the idea that we're going to say, here's 700,000 or 800,000 people. They came here, they're born in other countries. They came here, brought by their parents when they're young. Educated, you're growing up here, you want to contribute, we're going to send them home. Employers say to me, why does that make sense? That's like in our naked interest to try to make sure those people stay here and make a contribution instead of going back to where they were born and compete against us. The majority of Americans, three-quarters of Americans, I think, would like to see the Dreamers being given a chance to stay here, not become citizens right away. A piece of legislation we voted on last week was provided for, I think, a 12-year path to citizenship. And president could have played, I think, a more constructive role than he played on this. President sees himself as a deal maker, art of the deal. And there was just a crying need for somebody to play that role. I've been chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the United States Senate. I spent a lot of time on the border with Mexico, into Central America, into Mexico, meeting with all kinds of people, Border Patrol and others. I worked with a fellow named Kevin McLeelan, and he is the senior person in the Border Patrol. He's got tens of thousands of people who work for him along the border and elsewhere around the world. He says to me, we don't need any more people on the border. We don't need any more Border Patrol people. What we need are about 3,000 people at the border crossings where there's a lot of traffic, a lot of commerce that goes through. He says we need about 3,000 more people there. And he and I have laid out a whole lot of what we call them force multipliers. We call them force multipliers that would make the 20-some thousand Border Patrol that we have there far more effective. And it could be drones. It's drones with surveillance equipment, airplanes, helicopters. It's the dirigibles that go up 5,000 feet into the air with surveillance equipment. It's boats that can go along the Rio Grande River high speed, boat ramps to launch them. In some places, it's horses in high vegetation where your Border Patrol are up on a horse, you're able to see better. It's all kinds of stuff. It's always better intelligence. It's units, it's stationary towers, it's mobile towers, it's motion detectors, all kinds of stuff. And the commissioner of Border Patrol and I literally submitted this list. It costs less than $1 billion a year, and it includes some money for a wall where it makes sense, a lot of more money for fences, which makes sense. It could be roads alongside the fences, all kinds of stuff that would make the Border Patrol more effective. That would actually enhance our border security. There's a compromise to be held here, which would enable us to have better border security, which would enable us to meet the crying demands and needs of not just the Dreamers, the DACA folks, but also the employers who would like for them to stay here and work here.
Let's move on to the budget deal that was passed, 2-year budget deal earlier this month. What does that mean for Delaware?
There are a number of federally qualified community health centers in Delaware where thousands and thousands of people get cost-effective, low-cost health care. West Side is one. We have Henrietta Johnson up north. West Side is also located down here in Kent County, La Rede in Sussex County. And they provide health care every week to thousands of people, whether they have a dime to their names or a lot more money to their names. If they have insurance, that covers it. Otherwise, they can pay for it. But we've basically said, we're not going to let them run out of money. We're going to continue to fund them a little bit more money in the next couple of years. There's a program called CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a state-federal partnership that ensures, I want to say maybe as many as 9 million kids in our country. Again, cost-effective and for low-income folks. We extended the life of that program for 10 years, and it actually saves money. And we have some money that we're pushing toward broadband deployment. We've got it, especially in Sussex County, a lot of places where we don't have the ability to get access to the internet. It impedes our economic development and job creation in Sussex County. And that legislation, the budget deal, will help to address that. And there's some we have places around the country. We certainly have places in Delaware where we need some extra money for water and sewer. And we have needs in Sussex County that we're mindful of right now. And there's not something for everybody in that legislation, but a lot of places. I think the best thing that comes out of the legislation is certainly predictability. Instead of lurching from one continuing resolution to another, we've got to be smarter than this. And I think we finally have, and without a lot of help from the White House on this one, is in the Senate, Senator Chuck Schumer, there's a Democratic leader, Mitch McConnell, Republican leader, they worked it out with a lot of input from the rest of us. But it's an encouraging development.
You mentioned water earlier, and I know you've been very vocal in your criticism of the direction of the EPA under Scott Pruitt. How much do your concerns about the EPA grow when you look at the situation like the one we have in Blades with the contamination of well water there?
In Blades, they have a small town, about 1,200 people, and their wastewater treatment system is pretty old. And they have a contaminant that's measured in the parts per trillion, as I recall. Mm-hmm. But if you drink enough of it, it can be harmful to health. But it can be fixed by putting in a new filtration system in the place where they treat the water. And the problem with a lot of we have in other parts of Sussex County is there are high nitrates, the levels of nitrate, nitrogen, phosphorus, and a lot of it comes from agriculture, farming, fertilizer, and it could have something to do with the poultry industry, particularly if poultry litter is taken from poultry houses and farmers use it to spread it on their fields in inappropriate ways. So we have it's a lot easier to go into Blades and replace the filtration system, the charcoal filtration system. It's pretty expensive. But when you have hundreds of people or thousands of people with wells, their own individual wells, I've asked my staff, I said, figure out for us, for folks who have high levels of nitrates in their well water, is there a relatively inexpensive way for us to provide filtration as the water comes from their well to as it arrives at their home, so that the water that they drink and maybe bathe in and so forth, is pure. And it's like a miniature version for every house that's affected compared to Blades, where they have a big filtration filter that they're going to implant there this week.
Do these type of concerns make you worry more about the oversight EPA will provide to handle problems like this, to find problems like this, to help assess problems like this?
Well, there are a lot of good people at the Environmental Protection Agency. Their life work is to make sure we're safe, we have public health is protected, we have clean air to breathe and water to drink. The leadership at EPA is Scott Pruitt. I'm sure he's a smart guy, good lawyer. He should not be the person leading the Environmental Protection Agency. And he's taking him, in my judgment, I think in the judgment of a lot of people who know him, who work there, who've seen him. These to take him in the wrong direction. He'll be there for a while. He won't be there for long, and we're trying to make sure that the Congress, the Environment and Public Works Committee, where I'm the leading Democrat, senior Democrat, that we play the appropriate role that we should be playing to do oversight, congressional oversight, to make sure that the EPA is doing their job to protect our public health and make sure we have clean air and clean water. We clean up our brownfields. We clean up our hazardous waste sites.
Much of what we've discussed so far has been things that have been kind of points of frustration for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And this is an election year, a year in which you're up for re-election. Mm-hmm. You have both Republican and Democratic challengers that have emerged. What do you say to frustrated voters when you go out and ask them for their vote this year?
Oh, I really thank them. I served in our country in uniform, 23 years active in the Reserve Navy, as a naval flight officer in the Vietnam War and the Cold War. I love serving. I've considered a privilege. And the people, it's a perfect match for me. Folks here are fiscally conservative, and they believe in balanced budgets. They believe that it's important for us to provide a nurturing environment for job creation, job preservation. That's a big part of our jobs. And they're progressive on social issues. And that's really who I am. And so I found a little state, thank God, where I could be myself. I don't have to twist myself into a pretzel and pretend I'm somebody I'm not. It's who I am. And as it turns out, Delawareans seem to approve this message. So as long as they want me to serve them, I'm happy to do that. I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. They don't want me to do it for the rest of my life. But I feel just a great privilege to serve. I love this state. I love the people here.
Do you feel like voters might be a little bit more demanding this year, that they may say to you, okay, well, you know, DACA, you know, budgets, you know, guns, mm-hmm. you know, what are you going to do? You know, do you feel like you're going to get that more visceral kind of, you know,
amazing,
almost anger?
The amazing thing I felt, especially over the last year, actually since the last election, is greater support here in this state and across the country when people find out what I do than I've ever felt. I have people every day, many people every day, who come up and thank me for what I do and say thank you for being a voice of reason in a country where there's so much turmoil. He said, we need people like you who treat other people the way you want to be treated, who are trying to figure out what's the right thing to do and just to do it. People who are principled and stick to their principles, but also willing to work toward reasonable compromises with, you know, Democrats and Republicans and independents. So I think that's what the people in our state are looking for. We have, I call the four C's in Delaware, the four C's. It's sort of like the Delaware way. And the four C's include communicate, compromise, collaborate, and civility. And our congressional delegation, whether it's Chris Coons and Lisa Blunt Rochester, or Mike Castle, or Joe Biden, or Bill Roth, or Ted Kaufman, Pete DuPont, I think we all try to reflect and live our lives by those four C's. Whether we think of it or not, we actually do, to communicate and to compromise and to try to collaborate and to use civility.
Thanks to Senator Tom Carper for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We'll take a closer look at what's next for the Christina School District's Wilmington schools, now that the district and state have settled on a memorandum of understanding that aims to consolidate those schools. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The latest effort to address the needs of students in the Christina School District's Wilmington schools cleared a significant hurdle earlier this month. After 6 months of work and discussion, the district's school board, superintendent, and teachers' union agreed to a memorandum of understanding with Governor John Carney and the state's Department of Education, the framework for a plan to improve K-8 education for at least 1,400 kids in the state's largest city. But it is just a framework. As we've seen before on this issue, the devil is in the details, or more specifically, hammering them out. Contributor Larry Nagengast has been talking to the various parties involved about what's next on that road and the potential potholes along the way. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to walk us through what he learned.
Well, let's start with the key piece of this framework, consolidation of Christina's five Wilmington schools into two. Where does that stand right now? What does it look like right now?
Well, it's hard to believe that I'm saying this, but it took 6 months of talking and 2 months of passing a draft document back and forth just to get this memorandum of understanding approved. And not only is that just the first step in the process, but it might well turn out to be one of the easiest. So what do we have now? First, we've got an agreement that kids in five Christina schools in Wilmington will be moved into two buildings, Bancroft on the east side and Byard on the west side, in either a kindergarten through eighth grade or a first through eighth grade configuration. Kindergarten students may wind up at Stubbs Elementary. That's going to depend upon the final decision on where to put what they're calling a dual generation center, a place that's offering early childhood services for preschoolers and education, employment, and social services for adults. We've also got, in principle, a commitment for extra state funds, plans for a longer school day and a longer school year, after-school programs, incentives for teachers, and a bunch of other things that are intended to improve the learning environment. But all those details aren't spelled out. That comes next.
And not everyone is quite on board with this approach, this K through 8 or 1 through 8 configuration. What is the criticism of this approach?
Okay, so the school configuration is definitely an issue for some people. And the critics say it takes the kids out of their neighborhoods, so that weakens community bonds. They also don't think first graders and eighth graders should be in the same building. They worry about big kids bullying little kids, kids from rival turf causing disruption. Now, on the other hand, we know that Catholic schools have worked fairly well for years with a K through 8 or 1 through 8 model. And there's something to be said for going to the same school as your big brother or big sister, and for the continuity that staying in the same place for several years can bring.
And certainly, I think there's also that possibility of, as we've kind of talked about before, the idea of having those wraparound services and all very convenient for a family in one location.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a key point that the state has been making in this entire discussion. If you've got after-school programs, if you've got health services, all of those extra things that they're planning on adding on, if you've got that all in one place, it's easier to offer them and in a more concentrated way.
There are some pieces of this, though, that are getting some praise, and at least one that has drawn fairly universal praise, school hours. What's the plan with school hours under this MOU?
Well, okay, well, I don't know the exact time, start and close times of the schools, but, I mean, middle schools tend to start around 8 a.m., maybe a little bit earlier than that, and get out around 2, perhaps a little bit later. Elementary schools tend to start around 8:30. Under the MOU, no school in this plan would begin classes before 8:30 in the morning. This means that kids can sleep for a half an hour to an hour later in the morning. And on the back end, when you factor in the longer school day and the after-school programs that would be available, kids will still be in the school building until 3, maybe until 4 o'clock. You know, and this reduces the time that they're on the streets or perhaps at home unsupervised waiting for their parents to get back from work. If the kids get more sleep, they're going to be more ready to learn, less likely to miss school. If they're in school later, that means there's less time for them to get into trouble in the afternoons.
As I said in the intro to this segment, and as you point out in your piece, this is just a framework, and the devil is always in hammering out the details. Certainly one of those details is the timing of all this. A couple of benchmarks need to be reached. What are the kind of key benchmarks that we're looking at that have to be reached for this thing to even move forward from here?
Well, I'm not going to get into all of them, but the first two are March 31st and June 1st. These are the designated start and end dates for the school board and the Christina Education Association to work out a separate MOU on teacher pay and working conditions. The teachers union has been participating in all these meetings the last 6 months, but it really hasn't been very vocal. If they've got problems with the way this situation is developing, we're going to hear about it soon. But, you know, we are talking about extra pay and other incentives for working longer hours and a longer school year, and there's a limited amount of money in the pot for the district to work with. It would be nice for these negotiations to go smoothly, but I'm not going to bet on it. Now, the next big deadline is June 30th, and that's the end of the General Assembly's regular session, and that's all about the money.
And, of course, we talk about that all the time when it comes to this, the funding of it. How is this all going to be paid for? What are people saying about that part of the equation?
Okay, well, a couple of things here. First of all, the state is going to put up $2 million to get the dual generation center started, and another $1.5 million, which would be increased by 2% a year for this extra programming in the schools. But the General Assembly has to include that money in the budget. Now, related point here, most people that I've talked to say that an additional $1.5 million a year won't be enough to meet many of the needs of Christina schools in Wilmington. Second issue for the General Assembly. Governor Carney wants approval for a $15 million bond issue for renovations at Bancroft and Byard, and he wants to do it with an 80-20 state-local split rather than the traditional 60-40 split. Okay, so this may be a special case, but it's not a guaranteed easy sell. Now, related to that, one other step that's not specifically in the MOU, Christina's 20% share of that would be another $3.75 million. That's going to require Christina to go to a referendum, and passage would most likely depend on support from suburban voters, who wouldn't be seeing necessarily any improvements in the schools they attend if the tax hike is approved. So there's another tough sell there. So we've got deadlines and we've got money issues.
And the other tough sell that we've seen in the past is trying to get downstate and central Delaware legislators on board for this kind of money. Now, the one thing that Governor Carney has done this time is he's turned his opportunity grant program into one that is not a competitive grant, but it's going to be automatically sent to high-need schools, schools with high English language learners. Do you have a sense that that may be enough to get the buy-in necessary to get the money for the Wilmington schools from those lawmakers who've kind of balked unless there was money for other districts?
I think it might in terms of the operating funds. I'm not quite sure how this plays in terms of the $15 million bond issue for the school renovations, because this is again a special case and moving from a traditional 60-40 split to an 80-20 split, a lesser local share. I don't know how easy that's going to be to sell, but if I'm told that the governor is giving it his best shot, so we'll have to see how effective he can be in cajoling the General Assembly on this piece.
And the one thing that has often not been discussed is how those directly affected by all this feel about this framework and this plan going forward, specifically the parents of students at these schools. How do the parties involved seeing getting buy-in from families involved?
Well, back in August, it seemed like there was a great effort put into getting parents into these public meetings and hearings. I mean, Governor Carney even went door to door, knocking on doors, telling people, hey, we've got these meetings coming up, please attend, and so on. But parental participation tailed off as this whole process droned on. I mean, it was long. There were more meetings and meetings and meetings, and everything seemed to be moving at a snail's pace, really. Parents and community leaders did offer a lot of suggestions as well in those early meetings, but it was hard to keep them focused on key themes. I mean, they were all over the lot, and I don't mean to diminish the importance of one thing or another, but you start talking about the need for arts education in the school, and something else about more programs for low income children, and it was just all over the place, and it was hard for. Would be hard for anyone to try to boil that down and put it into an easily organized, easier to implement sort of package. So the bottom line was that a lot of people felt that there really wasn't enough community input, and whatever input there was wasn't heeded quite as much as it should be. So now moving forward, the work is going to focus even more on the details, and there's going to have to be more parent involvement. Everyone seems to want to hear more from parents, but it's a two-way street. You have to do better outreach to get the feedback that you're looking for, and it's really crucial that this happen. After all, if parents don't buy into the plan, it's not going to work. And now we just have to sit back and see what happens.
Comparatively speaking to with what we've seen before, specifically the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission, how does this look? How does this seem to be moving as compared to previous processes like that?
Well, I think in some respects this is a little bit better, emphasis on a little bit. The governor has made more of a commitment and more advocacy for the additional funding than he did last year, or that former Governor Mark Held did the year before that. So that's a bit of progress. And I mean, you do have the Christina Board of Education signing on to this. So yeah, that part of it is progress. They have not accepted, the governor's office, the state have not accepted the extensive funding recommendations that WEEC made, changing the formula for English language learners, special ed kids, kids in high poverty areas. So, I mean, in that respect, yeah, it seems that the money is really not there. It doesn't seem that the money's going to be adequate. But this is a step forward. You've got to step, you've got to take these baby steps, I guess, if you're going to get anywhere. Part of my concern over the long haul, even if this does move forward, is these baby steps get implemented and some people say, hey, it's working, and then they're going to say, well, we did that, so that's enough. And what's going on here right now is likely not to be enough. It's got to be viewed as merely a starting point.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week on The Green. Again, his piece on the Christina MOU and what's next is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with our latest arts playlist after a check on the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. Philip C. Shaw Elementary School in Shelbyville is teaming up with local artist John Donato to create a special History of Shelbyville mural in one of the school's hallways. Students began painting the mural in January and will continue working on it until it's unveiled March 7th. And the school is also hosting a series of related special events leading up to that unveiling. For this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with Laurie Hill, PCS's art teacher, and the mural's creator and artist, John Donato.
Laurie, tell me about the creation of the art mural.
Well, we've been working on this project for in its planning stages for about a year, and it's grown drastically. The original goal was to kind of just do part of the hallway with the scene from the main street of Shelbyville, and now it has grown to encompass about 300 feet of the hallway, both sides. And the main goal was to instill a sense of pride in our community, in the students. It's been here, the town of Shelbyville, and before they were here, and it will continue to grow with their help and change. So I wanted them to be able to be excited about that.
Talk to me about Philip C. Shaw, how the school and the students got involved in this project to begin with.
Well, we had worked with John Donato last year, actually, on a mural in our front hallway. And it basically just focused on something the school was working with the growth mindset attitude. And so we had a lot of words of wisdom and educational pieces to kind of teach that there. And then when I started to get the idea for this hallway, I knew that I would like to work with him as well. And then it was a totally different mural than the others that I had seen that he had done. So we kind of talked and made sure that that was something he was interested in, and he jumped on board. And we've been planning ever since.
All right, let's talk about a series of special events in the coming weeks leading up to the mural's unveiling.
Yeah, we began back in January. We had some local residents, Mr. Steve Carey and Mr. Jeff Mumford. They came and talked to our second graders really about innovation and the resourcefulness that the area has seen. And then that same day, we had Kelly Klein, who is the librarian from Shelbyville Public Library. She talked to our third through fifth grade ambassadors, who are going to kind of be the leaders and the tour guides for our museum. She talked about the history of the library, the history of Governor Townsend, and some of the historical events that were associated with that. And then we left out kindergarten. So we kindergarten studies in their social studies curriculum, community helpers. So the police chief of Shelbyville, Scott Collins, came in and talked to them about what it's like being a community helper in the town. And then his family is very deep-rooted in the community. So he talked about some of the history with that and kind of the different things that kindergartners might think were interesting about the area. And we actually had, on February 8th, the family of our school's namesake, Philip C. Shao. There are about seven of them that are still living. And they came in and talked to our first through fifth graders about the history of the school, about Philip Shao himself. And they actually came and painted with us, which was really cool. And the last event leading up to our unveiling was this week, which we had a donor day. And a thank you to kind of all the people that helped contribute monetarily to making this mural possible.
Laurie, how are the students reacting to all of this? I mean, it must be just eye-opening for many of them.
It is. It's fun to see them walk through the hallway. They pause. They talk about the things that they've learned. They've really been coming in with lots of questions and lots of statements that, you know, oh, my grandmother told me this, or, you know, my great-grandfather knew this person or knew about, you know, the fire of 1916 and just different things. It's so cool. Even down to the kindergartners, their interest level.
All right, so you're going to have, we're going to talk to the artist in a minute, John Donato, but before we get to John, the big unveiling is happening on March the 7th. Talk about that day. What's going to happen?
Okay, so at 1:30, we have our school-wide assembly. We're going to have Secretary of Education, Dr. Susan Bunting. She's going to come in and talk to the students a little bit about the mural. This is her hometown, so she has lots of good information to give them. We also have a mini documentary that they're going to view, taken of the process of the mural, so they're going to see themselves in it and kind of the history of everything. And then Dr. Bunting is going to come along with us for a ribbon cutting of the hallway, and Mr. Donato will probably speak a little bit to them. And then our third through fifth grade ambassadors, they're going to be giving tours to their classrooms. So all of the students in the school, K through fifth grade, and then that night they're going to be in charge of hosting like a museum setup. They're going to be taking tours of family and community members throughout the hallway. We have lots of artifacts from around town that are on loan from businesses, community members, all sorts of places. That will be placed throughout the hallway, and that will be guarded by our student group, the Boys with Purpose. And I think it'll be a fun night.
Well, this is also exciting. We're talking with Laurie Hall. She's the art teacher at Philip C. Shao Elementary. Laurie, I want to bring in John Donato. He's the local artist involved with this project. And, of course, it's a project that couldn't go on without John. John, how are you?
Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are
you?
Hey,
give me some background, your background, and then tell me how you got involved with this project.
My background was in business, so I worked in the corporate world for quite a while and became an artist, a full-time painter, about 10 years ago. And when I did, I was pretty much self-taught in the world of painting and quickly stumbled into murals, large-scale projects. And that's how I got my start.
And talk to me a little bit about the mural. I know PCS is creating the history of Selbyville. What's in the mural? What can we expect?
What you would see in the mural, there's a lot of history, and it's put in there in a very whimsical visual manner, and a lot of it was based on what the children were beginning to understand and learn through the classroom, on tours around town, on research that we could do together. Even a lot of the visuals, which are all painted by the students, are in the mural, so it's like a walking museum that teaches growth mindset concepts, creative process concepts, artistic skills, and history at the same time. So it's a very living mural that is accomplishing a lot while it's on the wall.
I was going to say it's really meant to make the children learn, right?
Absolutely. It really, first and foremost, it's a teaching mural. And it puts things on the wall in a way that it will never become invisible because there is so much to see. Each day you may walk down a different part of the hallway, find a little statement, find a little character, find a little situation that would leave you thinking about that till the next day. One of the most interesting things about that is it's designed so that the teachers, after the mural's finished, could use this in their lessons. So they could actually reference pieces of the wall to teach different things. And so the mural actually is set up so with reference points and mile markers that the teachers can actually present a question to students. They could go down the hall, and then the students can reflect and report back, what does that mean to them? How did it impact the area? How does it impact their life? And most importantly, how does it help them become more creative and more hardworking? How do they practice? How do they deal with failure? How do they manage fear? Things like that through how folks in history that lived in Selbyville have done that. So I think everybody's discovered that it's a very entrepreneurial, very resourceful history here. And it's something that the children can now understand through history and through their own creative process in creating a 300-foot mural.
John, how has it been working with the students, with the children?
It's been fantastic. They're so energized when they get there, and they're constantly feeding me ideas. One of the things that we saw since this mural, it's been about a month now we've been working on it, they're really learning a lot of artistic skills. When they showed up, Lori and I spent a lot of time understanding which grades are learning what artistic processes and skills and things like that. So we dealt with what they already knew, but then we made them stretch a little bit. So they've really become pretty good painters.
Thanks to Philip C. Shaw Elementary School art teacher Lori Hall and artist John Donato, as well as our Kelly Steele, for their time on this week's Arts Playlist. The Green wraps up next with Enlighten Me. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Joint Legislative Council has approved creating a memorial honoring women who served in the U.S. military. The plan is to put the new memorial on the northwest side of Legislative Hall. The idea for the Women's Military Memorial came from Delaware City resident Cheryl Dennis. And in this week's Enlighten Me, the former Marine chats with Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller about the inspiration for it.
So talk about your military experience.
Oh, wow. I went into the Marine Corps when I was 18, right out of high school. I actually enlisted when I was 17, and my parents had to sign for me. I absolutely thought it was the best thing. I loved being in the Marine Corps. I was definitely a woman in a man's military. But I always get the question about why I went into the Marine Corps versus any of the other branches. And for me, it was just because I always knew I wanted to go into the military, and if I was going to go in, I was going to go into the branch that I thought would challenge me the most.
So what year did you go into the military then?
I went to boot camp in October of 1983, and I graduated boot camp in December of 1983.
So talk about the different kinds of jobs, things that you did while you were in the military.
When I was in the military, my MOS was a communications operator. So a lot of the communications back then were done through teletypes and that kind of machinery. And so I had like a top secret cosmic atomic clearance because of the messages that we would receive and stuff. So I worked the shift work because communications never shuts down. So, day, night, weekends, I was working. We did all the things that Marines had to do. We had to qualify with the rifles. And we still had to run PT in every day. But I was very lucky in that I was indoor in peacetime, so I never saw conflict. But I went to boot camp in Parris Island, South Carolina, and then I went to my advanced schooling out in 29 Palms, California, which is where I learned to be a communications operator. And then I was down in Norfolk, Virginia for 2.5 years, and then I was in Okinawa, Japan for a year.
So how long were you in the military overall?
I was in for 4 years.
Okay, and so what do you do now?
Now I work at the Christiana Mall in the management office. I'm a property management associate.
Okay, and so you said that you were in Maryland and you saw a statue honoring women in the military, is that right?
I actually saw the sign off of I-95 and it said Maryland's Women's Veterans Memorial.
So what did you think when you saw it?
I thought that was a really cool idea. What can we do to get one in Delaware? And so I reached out to, like I said, to our constituent, our senator here for Delaware, or for Delaware City, Senator Poore, and she's like, I don't know, let me look into it and see if we can make it happen. So,
when you see statues or whatever dedicated to women, they're mostly in skirts.
Right.
So as a veteran, you know, when you see those types of statues, you know, what do you think about?
I understand that's the way it probably was historically. I mean, when, you know, some women first went in, they were, you know, the nurses and that kind of thing. But that's not the way it is now. And even, you know, since when I served till today, it's even so much more different. You know, when I was in, women didn't go on the front line. Now they do. You know, totally different. It's just the, you know, progression of how it is.
Do you feel like women don't get enough recognition for what they contribute to defending, you know, the nation?
I think once people realize that women do defend it, they do. But I don't think people look at women as being the initial veterans. I mean, we go out for Veterans Day. You know how they always have, you know, come here and you get a free dinner type thing? If it's my husband and I, they'll thank my husband. And my husband will be the first one to say, no, it's not me, it's her.
Thanks to Cheryl Dennis and our Sarah Mueller for enlightening us this week about a women's military memorial coming to Legislative Hall. Photos of women veterans will be laser etched on the monument. The deadline to submit photos or artwork to the Delaware Heritage Commission for possible placement on the memorial is March 15th. Photos to be considered for the book being produced in conjunction with the memorial must be submitted by July 15th. And that's all the time we have on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenTE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.